Oh, he's in Hawaii.
Oh, that guy.
Yeah, can you believe that?
Welcome, everybody, to the Senate Interim Committee on Business and Transportation. For the record, this is November 14th, 2017. We have a number of updates and reports today. And the first one, I think, is on a license plate.
Oh, no, no. First
no?
one will be Trailblazers Foundation, Mr. Chairman.
Huh?
We're going to start with the Trailblazers Foundation.
That's what I said.
Oh, yeah. That's right. There is a license plate involved.
That's
in
where the money comes from.
The chair, the chair is always right. That's the rule. The chair is always right, of course, Mr. Chair.
Please.
Full agenda.
It is the foundation, but the money comes from. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Beyer, members of the committee. My name is Michael Llewellyn, Vice President of Corporate Communications for the Portland Trailblazers. When last we spoke with some of you, we were seeking your support for House Bill 2730. We thank those who voted for us for the successful passing of the bill, which created the Portland Trailblazers license plate. As you know, it's the last license plate to have to go through the full legislative process, that now the process for specialty plates is handled by the Oregon Department of Transportation and the DMV. Per statute, we agreed that we would bring back to the legislature a report on how the surcharge on the plate is being utilized, and that is why we are here before this body today. You will hear from two of my Trailblazer colleagues to my immediate right, Krista Stout, who is Vice President of Social Responsibility, and to her right, Annie Klug, who is Director of Community Programs. They will take you through the results through the first several months of the plates being on sale here in the state of Oregon.
When did they first go on sale?
September the 1st, 2016.
2016, okay, so a little over a year.
Thank you so much. So again, my name is Krista Stout, and I am with the Trailblazers. I also oversee the Trailblazers Foundation. So just to give you a little bit of context, the Trailblazers Foundation raises about $1 million a year, and we give throughout the region to youth initiatives, both through nonprofits, schools, and directly to kids to help them get through college. So we were founded in 2011. We're a 501c3, so we actually have a separate board that governs us with internal and external members from the company. This report is specific to how we spent the license plate dollars that were raised throughout Oregon over the past, well, from September 1st through June 30th of 2017, which was the end of our fiscal year. Any license plate proceeds raised from July 1st of this year through June 30th of next year will be in next year's report. So in this packet, there is a bunch of information. The total license plate proceeds were $233,000. $233,726. We, from the foundation, added an additional $88,000 so that we could grant a total of $322,000 throughout the state of Oregon. Within this report, you'll see, we'll walk through it, but there's a map of Oregon with locations that shows where the grants that we gave to are serving communities throughout the state, as well as a full list of the nonprofits who received funding, a list of what areas the grantees serve by county, and a list of the Trailblazers Foundation board members as well. Also, for the Trailblazers Foundation gives through the areas of LIVE, which is our focus on the environment, LEARN, which is our focus on education, and PLAY, which is our focus on sport and physical activity. And again, all of those grants are focused on youth. So I just wanted to go through a couple of the key numbers from the granting from license plate dollars. No administration costs were taken from license plate funds, so all of the funds that came to us from the sale of license plates went back out into the community. We received 197 applications from 61 cities in Oregon, about $2.8 million in requested funding, and were able to grant $322,100 in funding to 46 organizations across the state. All of the organizations are serving youth from one or more historically underserved communities, so whether that's Native, youth with disabilities, low-income youth, any kind of category you can imagine. 75% of our grantees serve communities outside of the Portland metro area, and just so you know, from September 1st, 2016 to September 1st, 2017, we sold 8,519 license plates. So Andy's going to talk a little bit about the process of how we get and give dollars through this grant and some communication as well.
Thank you. So from a process perspective, this application is available online. So it's on the Trailblazers Foundation website, and it is accessible to any organization in the state of Oregon that has a 501c3, again, focused on those live, learn, and play focus areas. So from February through April, we collect applications from across the state. As Krista mentioned, we received 197 this year alone. And then we go into a review process. So we actually use committees that have expertise in each of those areas to work with us and our staff for a review process to ultimately choose grantees. And then that is run through our board. So as a governing board, they're approving all the grants that go out. That money was then distributed in July. Organizations can get up to $10,000, and as she also mentioned, there's 46 organizations that received grants of varying amounts. From a communication perspective, we have a lot of relationships with nonprofits across the state, are always looking for more organizations to be able to share this with. So that includes organizations like the Oregon Community Foundation that has presence in many of those communities. It also includes a lot of our marketing assets. So from the company perspective, whether it's newsletters, social media, radio drops, all of those pieces we're making sure that get to different communities so that they know that they can apply. So what we would love is just help us get the word out. As many communities as know about it, we always are looking for more applications from more communities across the state. And so that website there is currently active with all of our foundation information. And then the this specific grant application period will be again available February through April. And so sharing that website, and we'll have more to come as it gets closer, and would be a great help to us to get more funds across the state.
You mentioned the recognition as well?
We actually were able to host at the beginning of this season, actually on opening night for us, all of the organizations we invited from across the state to join us at a game. So we had a great time with them, a pre-game celebration. We were able to meet them in person, talk to them about the work that they were doing, and present them collectively a check on the court. So that helped to be able to also tell that stories within their own communities about the money that they're receiving from the Trailblazers Foundation, and the hope is that that will raise the profile even more so more people in their communities know they can apply.
Super. So I'm trying to remember, and I can't. Is this one set up, this plate set up, with each time they renew the license plate, they have to pay again?
Okay. Yep. Chair Bayer, yes. Each time the surcharge is $40. So you'll pay it, obviously, when you get your first plate.
Cool.
And then when you renew. So it does set up, I don't want to say a perpetual amount of funding, but hopefully as long as people are Trailblazers fans and still driving vehicles in the state of Oregon, that there'll be dollars that will be funneled to the foundation for the purposes that you just heard.
Yeah. We did pretty well, 8,500, almost 8,600 plates out there.
Great. Yes, Chair Bayer, our strength in terms of marketing and promotion tends to be during the season. Our friends at ODOT and the DMV did a great job providing us with monthly data and updates. So it tends to sort of ebb and flow in terms of the sales. And as you know, certain times of the year, more vehicle plates are being renewed than others. More new car sales are happening more than others. But we are in that prime period now with Trailblazer basketball having just started, where we utilize all of our assets from a 21 radio station, Trailblazer Radio Network across the state, to our television broadcast, to every night when we've got 18, 19,000 plus of the Rip City faithful in the building, they always see or read something about those Trailblazer plates.
Cool. Well, you did what you said you were going to do. Senator Riley.
Thank you. I have one of the early ones. I got mine a year ago, I guess. So, and you've been doing a great job. I see them all over the place now, and I do notice them. And I have people who have plates wave at me because they have plates and I have plates. So,
cool.
I think it's great.
Anybody else?
They see on TV.
Any other questions? Yeah. Thank you very much for coming down, and good luck with it, and go Blazers.
Chair Bayer, thank you. Members of the committee, thank you very much.
Good game last night.
All righty. Next up, talk a little bit about wave energy. So, Patrick, do you have any intro? Or
Mr. Chair, I think I'm going to go next door. If you want to put us on pause real quick, and I'll go see next door if Senator Roblin can come join us.
Okay. Okay. That'd be great.
Good
You may have, if you have the same number of people testifying that came and visited me, we may have to bring up more chairs.
They don't
come apart easy.
All right.
Okay,
don't
worry.
Red.
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, I'm Belinda Batten. I'm the Executive Associate Dean of the College of Engineering at Oregon State University. Thank you for having us here to testify about the wave energy test facility planned for off the coast of Newport, Oregon, called PEMEX SETS. We've been developing this facility over the last 5 years, we being Oregon State University, to serve as the premier test facility for wave energy technologies. It's planned to have four test berths, so accommodating four different testing clients at any given time. It'll be available for up to 20 wave energy converters at any time, producing up to 20 megawatts. And those wave energy converters will be connected to the electrical grid, and Central Lincoln People's Utility District will be the utility that we'll be working with. We've been working to pre-permit this facility over the last 5 years to ensure smooth access for the testing clients. So we've been working extensively with the regulators and the regulatory agencies, resource agencies, to understand the requirements that would be placed on the testing clients. By pre-permitting, it'll reduce their costs and reduce the time to testing for those folks. In December of this last year, U.S. Department of Energy contacted me, and they awarded OSU $35 million to complete the design, the permitting, cost estimates on the facility in a first phase, then to complete the construction in a second phase, and a third phase to begin operation and maintenance for us to understand what it looks like to test these converters. That funding comes with a requirement of providing 20% of the total project costs from non-federal sources. To understand the economic development that will come with such a facility, we look to the European Marine Energy Center in Orkney, Scotland, which today is the premier test facility. We'll overtake them when our facility is going. And over the last 12 years, they've had about 300 jobs created. Now, if you look at what those jobs represent, what kinds of jobs, Scotland doesn't have a manufacturing sector. So if you're a testing client who has a technology, you'll manufacture that technology somewhere else and then have it towed to Scotland or shipped in some way. Oregon has the added benefit of having a vibrant manufacturing sector where we can manufacture these wave energy converters within Oregon and then follow on in the kind of protocols that European Marine Energy Center does. We've worked on this project with the community very closely. We've done extensive community engagement, both in the siting of the project and in looking to make sure the project suits community needs along the way. One of our premier stakeholders have been the fishermen, and they've been excellent partners with us finding the ocean site for the testing part of the project. And we appreciate the support of the community of Newport and the other coastal communities in this project. With that, I'm going to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Spinrad.
Yes. Thank you, Dr.
If we could, would you give Arnie, Senator Roblin, a chance to comment, please? So we can get back to work.
Yes, I have my other committee going on. I just wanted to come and you've already started to hear. You have the opportunity to hear some really brilliant people talk about an amazing project. And I just want to put some context. You know, Oregon State University and the people in Newport have done some pretty amazing things over the last few years. If you look at the material that was submitted to the federal government to get NOAA to move from Seattle to Oregon. A lot of these people are the same people that made that happen, and no one thought it could. This project, California wanted really badly. So did other places. But again, we have some brilliant people who work really hard at doing it and a community that's willing to make the efforts to do those kinds of things. And when you put all that together, Oregon is one of those places where when we put our mind to things, we get things done. And that's what I think is really important about this project. The issue is we need to have some of our own skin in the game. And, you know, you're going to hear about this whole project. You just heard that we need to come up with 20%. And the Oregon State is working hard to get an outside investment, and they will be getting that. That's part of the deal. But we really made a commitment, I felt myself, a couple of years ago for about $5 million. We gave them a little bit to make sure we got the grants and all that kind of stuff done. But then we actually got it. Now we have this thing, which I think, from Oregon's perspective, is not because we need to have these converters off the Oregon coast. We get a lot of power from the river and other places. But the world needs these converters. The islands of the Pacific need these converters. There are lots of places. We need to be the brain power behind making them work. And our ocean, there is no place better to test it, because they aren't going to get tested any harder than the Oregon coast weather. If you look at the waves we have, the wind we have, the other kinds of things that are happening, if they stand up to this test site, if they can make it through that, they're going to make it any place in the world. And we want to be that place where those companies and others come from all over the world to use our manufacturing in around the Portland area to bring it down the river and put it out there and find out if it works, so that they can export that technology to the rest of the world. And we need to be a part of that as the state of Oregon. And you're going to hear more about it. You're going to hear some people who have spent a long time. We had one person who you already heard from who was here helping us do this. Then she left us. Then she came back. And we really appreciate that, because it's really – it's been an amazing story for a long time about originally the first converters. Oregon State was developing them. It wasn't that they were trying to test other people's. It was they were coming up with the information that was necessary to convert that energy that is out there in the ocean to make electricity that could be used by people. This is the first place other than Scotland where they can actually test it in the grid. Can we get the power directly offshore into our grid? That's what they need to do to take to the next step, and that's what we want to be the place in the world where people come to make that kind of stuff happen. And you're going to get to hear from these people about that. So thank you, and
thanks
for having the opportunity.
Thank you,
yep. Any questions before I run back to education?
Any questions, Art? No?
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Well, let's go back.
Right.
Dr. Spinrad.
Thank you, and thank you, Senator Roble. Chairman Byron, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to provide some comments today. Senator Byron, you may remember about 4 years ago, I was the vice president for research at Oregon State
University.
Remember
very well.
My name is Rick Spinrad. I am now the senior advisor to the vice president for research at Oregon State University and also a professor of oceanography. And I left Oregon State to serve a two-and-a-half-year sentence back in Washington, D.C., with NOAA, in fact. It's sort of staying in the family. And back then, you may recall, Senator Byer, specifically, that working with then VP for Research at University of Oregon, Kimberly Espy, we developed a lot of the concepts around the RAIN accelerator. There's some similarities between what we did there and what we were planning on doing with respect to PMACsets in terms of accelerating and incubating mm-hmm. new business opportunities. The PMACsets test site really has advantages from an economic perspective, from an educational perspective, and also from an environmental perspective. And I'd like to focus, obviously, today on some of the economic components. It's about jobs, and it's about new business development, business creation. On the jobs side, the project will have basically three phases, and we've just started now in the first phase, which is the design phase. The second phase will be a construction phase. And the third phase, which will be several years long, will be the operations phase. And in each of those, there are job opportunities of a wide diversity. And that's an important point, because a lot of people tend to think, well, if you're developing something on the coast, it's really those immediate marine technology kinds of jobs. And I'd just like to point out that, yes, there are certainly coastal survey and mapping kinds of jobs that will be required for this. But there's also civil and electrical engineering opportunities. There are specific activities associated with cable laying. There are activities during the operations which are around systems administration and management, as you'd find in any utility operations center. So this opportunity for probably what will be several hundred jobs in a variety of different sectors is pretty attractive in terms of an investment from the state. New business development, as you'll hear later from several of the other witnesses, this is an opportunity to take some emerging businesses, some small businesses, and give them the leg up and the opportunity to demonstrate their capability so that they can enter the market as a demonstrated, viable, economically valuable approach to an energy solution. As an employee of Oregon State University and a faculty member there, I'm attracted by some of the educational opportunities here. There is clearly going to be benefit. Even though this is at the highest technology readiness levels, there are students and grad students and postdoctoral candidates who will be attracted by the opportunities to develop new knowledge from these tests that will be ongoing on a regular basis. And finally, on the environmental side, this really is an opportunity. Oregon is a special place. The state has an environmental technology leadership role. We've demonstrated it repeatedly in a variety of different technologies around renewable energy. This is a way of elevating that, taking this to the next level in terms of global recognition of our environmental technology responsibilities and capabilities. And I would point out this is not specific to wave energy. A lot of what we will be doing with this test facility is equally applicable to a variety of different renewable applications, including most notably wind energy. How do you connect that to the grid? What are the different test protocols and procedures that you might want to try for new applications of wind energy? So I see this activity as having great value economically, educationally, environmentally. And in the end, it's about advancing the lives, livelihoods, and lifestyles of Oregonians as we take a lead among players around the world. Thank you.
Thank you, Doc. Who's next?
Senator Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tim Munden. I'm the chief engineer with Acilla Power. We're developing a wave energy converter that we believe will significantly reduce the cost of generating electricity from ocean waves and also potentially a client at PMAX sets. As when I start, let me give you a little bit of background. Our development has been supported by a combination of private investment and public funds. In terms of public funds, primarily the U.S. Department of Energy. And the technology has recently been independently validated through the Department of Energy's Wave Energy Prize, where we demonstrated the potential to more than double the current state of the art, a threshold the DOE has identified as being required to make ocean wave energy viable. In our development to date, we have pursued a stage-gated technology development philosophy, enabling us to evaluate and improve the technology through a number of increasing scale technology demonstrations. Starting at 1 in 60th scale laboratory tests, so small devices, we recently worked our way up to 1 in 20th scale tests at the U.S. Navy Basin in Maryland. It's about the largest scale that you can test in a laboratory environment. And we're currently working on a system that will be tested in Hawaii in about 18 months' time that's going to be around about a third the size of a utility scale system. The next step after that will be the design and testing of a full-scale, utility-scale, 1-megawatt device. That will be pre-commercial, and that will be the final step before being able to sell these devices. This staged approach of numerical model investigation and refinement, followed by verification from the lab to the ocean, is the industry standard in marine engineering. At the moment, the opportunities for Acilla to take that next step and test a megawatt-scale wave energy device are extremely limited. Few test facilities available worldwide. There are facilities in Europe, but the only facilities in the U.S. is at the wet site in Hawaii, and they have limited waves, they have limited logistics, and you also need agreements with the Navy and the Department of Energy in order to be able to test there. The only alternative for anybody, including ourselves, is to undergo complex environmental, permitting, social, and engineering challenges associated with developing a brand new site to test. But a small company like ourselves, we're not in the position to undertake that. So what we need is a facility to be able to take our system to, connect to the existing infrastructure, and then evaluate system performance before taking that next step. PMAX Sets is able to offer that opportunity for a company like Acilla to be able to test a utility-scale system in a fully energetic open ocean environment. This allows us to be able to focus on the technology development and validation and not the permitting of a site. For the location of PMAX Sets as well allows easy access and logistics to us for the for our location in Seattle. It enables access to contractors and facilities on the U.S. West Coast and in Oregon. An extensive marine support infrastructure and construction capability. Furthermore, we can see that the development of this site, as has happened in other test sites around the world, like EMEC, like the Belinda testified to, will further encourage the development of support infrastructure, encouraging jobs, and further economic development. The bottom line I see is that Oregon has got one of the best marine energy resources in the country, nay, the world. And if a number of devices can be demonstrated through this site, the state can become known globally as a focus of the new marine energy industry.
Thank you. Senator,
how do you, on like this test site, do you get charged for the use of this test site? How does all that work? You come down and it's all set up and you're going to test what you're working on. Do you pay the college? Is it a per hour, per week? How does all that work? I've never been explained that.
Sorry, Belinda.
Sorry about the musical chairs.
That's okay. So, Senator Beyer, Senator Thompson, customarily there will be birth fees, and the typical a period of time where somebody like Osceola Power would want to test would be a minimum of a year, because they want to see the entire seasonal cycle. They want to be subjected to the extreme waves of the wintertime and see if their technology is going to be sensitive enough to get good energy even in the summertime when our waves are small. We did an industry survey a few years ago, and a year was a minimum, and some testing clients said they'd like to test for 2 or 3 years. So we would have birth fees. Right now, a lot of the testing clients that go into the facility in Hawaii, their berthing fees are paid by the U.S. Department of Energy.
Okay.
So that could happen that way. It could happen that they could have private investment, but we will be getting the berth fees, so that will pay our operating costs.
Great.
Well, you'll get some fees, I assume, off the sale of the power.
We're busy talking with Central Link and People's Utility District about how that would look as well. Yes, thank you, Senator Beyer.
Great.
Make some space.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for listening. My name is Tom Hickman. I'm with Vigor Industrial, located in downtown Portland, as well as Clackamas. Senator Thompson, we've talked before in the past with that facility, which would be part of this. This is really exciting for us because this means jobs. This is an opportunity for us to leverage what we're getting an opportunity to do, and that is become a premier site for the development of what will be a technology that will be utilized around the world, especially in the Pacific Rim, where you have remote islands, where you have coastal areas that are highly populated but need consistent power. This is really an interesting situation. We have the technology, we have the skills, we can add to those in training additional manpower. This will go on during the manufacturing process for these devices, and then that some of that will follow on for maintenance long term, and ultimately this will develop into a business that is fairly robust, and we have an opportunity to be the center of that. I was blessed today to get a call while I was down here that we have just been awarded another project from a company out of Ireland to build a wave energy device that will go to Hawaii for the initial test. Mm-hmm. This company now has plans to build 3 additional units that will go to this test bed. So my ask here is that we're going to need some help financially, and it will go to the good of employing people within the state of Oregon.
Sure.
My name is Deborah Smith, and I'm the general manager of Central Lincoln PUD. So we're the utility that will interconnect with SETS. In addition to being a PUD, we're a Bonneville full requirements customer. So our interest in this is not about the power per se. And Senator Beyer, I would remind you that you mentioned Bonneville's long position. So the power on the market currently does not have an extraordinarily high value. But we've been committed and have been working with OSU long before I started here. So I've been at Central Lincoln for going on 5 years. And it's exciting in the last year to see the project moving into a different direction, or not a different direction, but to the next stage, so that it feels like something that's really going to happen. And our staff is excited, and we're excited to work with them and to talk about what that means. So I really want to just mention three things to you, three reasons why this project is of a particular importance to Central Lincoln. And one is that emergency preparedness is something that we think about all the time. And coastal resiliency is something that I think that you all think about, or many of you think about on a regular basis. And while this is a test facility and not a production facility, so it won't be capable of providing or meeting our needs following any kind of a significant event, it's extremely important in my mind to develop renewable resources, distributed energy resources that can be deployed across a range of environments. And as we all know, that for much of Oregon, existing options around solar, et cetera, are sometimes hard, and that's really true at the coast. So we're excited to see or to be part of looking at other ways of potentially meeting those needs in the future. And we all know that emergency preparedness has a very long planning horizon. I talk about a 20-year plan, and then I tell my staff, when we get to the end of the 20 years, and I won't be here, by the way, I'll have retired, but when we get to the end of the 20 years, we'll just be ready to start a new 20-year plan, because we'll never really be ready. So exciting opportunities there. We're resource agnostic, I would say. So this project is exciting to us, but we've also been involved in and looked at other things like offshore wind. So we're just generally interested in renewables that fit across a broad range of Oregonian needs. So the other thing is, or number two, microgrids. So microgrids are very important to us when we look at serving community needs. So we operate in parts of 10 cities along the central coast of Oregon. And those cities all have different needs, and they have different ways of funding those needs, and they think about their resiliency goals in different ways. And so we actually are currently participating with the Oregon Department of Energy in a project that's funded with a grant from the National Governors Association, and it's all about grid modernization. And it's got a focus, again, on resiliency and how you could use microgrids as a way of helping individual communities stand up and meet their own emergency and priority needs. So we look at the opportunity to work with OSU on integrating resource as a way of learning about how our grid could work. We were very fortunate a number of years ago, before I came here, to receive funding from the Department of Energy, and so we have a smart grid in place in our service territory. And so this is a natural next step for us to learn about how we could use that investment that we've made, and that we made with the help of the federal government, to again serve local needs. So lastly, I would say that in general, the opportunity to learn about integration and to think about how distributed energy resources could be part of an overall resiliency strategy is really important to us, to the communities we serve, and I agree with others that have spoken before me, to the state of Oregon in general. We, in the work that we're doing with NGA, although we talk about coastal resiliency, we think a lot about how the things that we learn could be deployed in Bend, could be deployed where there's a wildfire. So we are looking at the scalability and how the things that we learn using technology to meet local needs can be utilized throughout the state. And I think this is another example of that. Working with OSU on this project has been great for my staff, for my engineering and operation folks. We're learning a lot, and I think those resources come back to serve the state in a bigger way. So thank you.
Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Scott McMullen. I'm chairman of the Oregon Fishermen's Cable Committee. I live in Astoria. It would be disingenuous of me to suggest that the fishing industry is in love with marine renewable energy. We have nothing against it. It's just typically where marine renewable energy projects want to be located is where we want to fish. So in general, the fishing industry isn't real big on marine renewable energy. This particular project is an exception because this site was developed with fishermen sitting down with the researchers at Oregon State to come up with a site that had the minimal amount of impacts on the fishing industry. In fact, most of us in the fishing industry think that this process is really the standard that the Bureau of Ocean Energy Management should be following around the country. It's the Oregon way of doing things is really works very well. Carbon is affecting our ocean. There's no question. We're seeing the effects now. Ocean acidification is starting to affect our fisheries, and so wave energy will be coming. I mean, it's a given. From the fishing industry perspective, we need the devices that come to be efficient, effective, and take the smallest amount of space possible. And so that's why a test facility like this is a good fit. Oregon has tremendous waves. I printed out the weather forecast, the marine weather forecast for today. Happens that today are significant waves on the Oregon coast, 21.6 feet. The max wave today, 36.7 feet is what the forecasters are predicting. So it's not so much that it's going to be a trick to produce electricity. It's going to be a trick to produce electricity and get the devices to survive. And that's what this facility is going to do. So I think it's a place the fishing industry has come to recognize that this is sort of an exceptional case where they're going to make devices, find out how to make them better, make them work, take up less space. The last thing we want is to have a field of wave energy buoys out there that aren't working and sort of cluttering up our grounds. So Senator Roblin did an excellent example of saying why this place is a good place to test. We have the wave climate here that provides the very savage weather that needs to be that these devices need to be tested in. And finally, while I was at sea recently, I read an article in Sea Technology magazine, and it talked about the Chinese and their investment in wave energy. They're investing millions of dollars on over 100 wave energy projects, and it would be a shame for U.S. companies on the West Coast to have to take our devices to China for an equivalent size test facility, where we know what would happen to the proprietary technology, it would be lost. So we'd urge your support of this project. Thank you.
Questions? Well, thank you. It's really interesting, and actually, from the time we talked in my office earlier today, I was thinking about it. And while wave energy at the rates that we know about likely today may not fit into Oregon's grid very effectively, you're right. They would fit in a lot of other offshore, the communities. I mean, I think Hawaii energy rates are close to 50 cents a kilowatt hour. So that's in market. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Wait a minute.
One more question. Do you know what the ask will be? It sounds like there'll be an ask soon for part of the 20%.
So the short answer is roughly half of what the match is required by Department of Energy. And there's a little fuzziness because we see this, the match is 20% of the total project, total. We're looking at a $50 million project, so nominally $10 million total match, and we would look to the state for in the neighborhood of half of that. Now, the challenge comes in terms of the phasing. This is a five-year project from the Department of Energy broken up into three budget phases, and what we are trying to do is to see how we might make that ask in an appropriate manner that synchronizes the state's budget cycle with the phasing that we've gotten from the Department of Energy, federal Department of Energy. Is that fair, Linda?
Yes.
Okay.
follow up?
Yeah, please.
Pay attention.
Follow up. Please follow up.
So will that be each phase, there'll be a match that you'll have to make, or will it be at the beginning or the end?
It's, go ahead.
So in each phase, there is a match. The state very kindly provided $800,000 for phase one, which came pretty close to getting what we needed. Not entirely, but we were entrepreneurial. And then we're looking for another, taking that $5 million that Dr. Spinrad talked about, splitting it in half, and we're asking for roughly half in the short session for 2018 is what I understand Senator Roblin is putting together.
With the hope for a follow-up then in subsequent session. Okay.
More?
That's it.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Anything else? Thank you.
Thank you very much. Exciting project.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate your time.
All righty. So now we're down to overview of... Do we want to do that, or we want to do real ID complaints?
I think they're here in the red.
You ready to go? Let's do it, Chris. Come on. Oregon Business Development. So this is our colleague. Remember we said last time we're going to spend the interim learning a little bit more about the economic development project. We got the overview last time, so hopefully we're diving a little deeper into one or more of your programs today.
I didn't know if he'd come back or not.
We were afraid to come back.
Well, Chris didn't come back.
You get the other
Chris. Different Chris.
Chair Beyer, committee members, thank you for having me today. My name is Chris Cummings. I'm the Assistant Director for Economic Development for Business Oregon. You did have an overview with this. We're going to talk about infrastructure today, but I'd like to just touch on a few things on a high level within our agency. Is one of the things, as you can see, recently we went through a strategic planning effort, and we've developed a new vision and mission and strategies for our department. I'm not going to go that deeply into those, but as you can see from our mission, it's quite diverse in that we serve communities, people, promote global competitiveness, and so on. What our name implies isn't necessarily what we are as a department. And what may be helpful for some of you as you're out in your communities to hear is that a lot of people refer to us as IFA, Infrastructure Finance Authority, Cultural Trust, Oregon Business Development Department, or Business Oregon. We are, in fact, Business Oregon. All those departments are within, all those sections are within our department. Like any other department, we have boards and commissions. These are just four of them that relate to our infrastructure programs. We have many more, of course. Our overriding commission is the Business Development Commission, but we also have the Infrastructure Finance Authority, hence why sometimes our name gets confused.
So you kept that name? I thought in the reorganization you did away with that.
We did away with it, the Infrastructure Finance Authority. We did away with it in a sense. We still have a board per statute that's the Infrastructure Finance Authority, and some of the programs and I'll point them out that we go over today fall within the authority of that IFA board.
All right. Obviously
for us, why talk about infrastructure? Infrastructure is most of our budget, as you can see, about 72% of our budget. We see infrastructure as economic development, hence why it's in our department. It's the groundwork for everything that we do economic development. When we talk about business attraction down the road, it probably had something to do with us working on water lines or industrial site development or brownfields, et cetera, and we'll cover some of that. So, our infrastructure programs have three key areas, and it's really to support growth, as I just mentioned, of local economies. If you're a business and you don't have fire suppression, you're not going to move there. If you're another business and you don't have ample roads or any other necessary infrastructure, broadband infrastructure, utilities, you have a difficult time moving there. So, again, infrastructure is really the base of all of our efforts that we do in economic development. Give you a little bit about the need of infrastructure across the state is that, as you can see from this, in 2016, Oregon League of Cities did a survey of just cities around the state, and this is what they came up with: $7.6 billion over 20 years in water, wastewater treatment facilities, another $3.7 billion in transportation, surface transportation facilities. That's just those two elements of infrastructure, and it's only cities that answered this survey. So I get asked all the time, what is the need for infrastructure? And we could probably go on for that for days. The fact is that most of our infrastructure, particularly when we talk about water and sewer and related facilities, they were built 80 to 100 years ago. They were built and they've been with a 40-year life or 30-year life, and they've been patched and put together over and over again by our good public works directors across the state. So these are the programs that we have within our infrastructure section. We're going to talk about the blue ones on the left today. I'm happy to talk about any of the programs as we move forward. You're welcome to stop me, of course. What we do, as you can see, most of these are pretty obvious. We have, and we'll go through them, but we also have the ones we're not going to talk about, community development block grants, ports. We have a ports program that manages monies for ports, et cetera. Seismic rehabilitation for schools and emergency service buildings. Broadband, we have a broadband program. And regional infrastructure fund. So the reason I want to get to that is what it is it's the RST funding. They have a program for funding for RST, the regions, and we manage those funds for them. They do the selection process. We manage the contracts behind the scene work. So Business Oregon infrastructure programs, why do people use us, our programs? Well, for one, is we have immediate access to cash. We have pools of cash in each of our different funds. Some of it's not sufficient to meet the need, as you can imagine, given what I mentioned about the study earlier. But we have immediate cash for most cases. We have favorable interest rates. Right now, we'll talk about the SPWF, or Special Public Works Fund. That's our most versatile fund. The interest rate's 3.5%, and it can go out over 30 years. A lot of times communities want it 25, 20 years. It depends on their own situation. And we have staff expertise. Our staff are all around the state. They communicate with each other. They have years and years of experience in infrastructure funding. And most of the communities that we work with, and you'll see from some of the slides moving forward, are rural small communities that don't have the capacity staffing-wise or financially to do these projects. Particularly to put together the financial packages, if you will. The thing when I mentioned about immediate access to cash, obviously a small city like Joseph may not have $3 million to do sewer or water upgrades. We have that cash. They also don't have access to bonding in many cases. And that's where our cash, and we have capabilities to bond as well, comes into play. They can't even go out on their own and raise the capital. So we'll talk about our Special Public Works Fund. As I mentioned, it's our most versatile fund. It's available to pretty much, or I should say, most local jurisdictions, whether it's ports, cities, counties, vector control districts. There's all kinds of districts out there that it's available to. It's not available to schools. And that's one big thing, obviously, that the legislature chose to make. What it's for is industrial site development, emergency projects we fund. If FEMA, if an emergency occurs and FEMA awards infrastructure money for a community, we can provide that 25% match that FEMA requires to cities as a grant. Most of this money and most of our programs are loan monies. The legislature tasked us with that, is that we have to prudently manage our funds. So we're very careful in what we give out in grants, although we do have grants, but our target is to manage these funds as revolving loan funds. So we get plenty of questions of, can I have a grant? And I feel bad saying all the time no, but once in a while I get to say yes. So it depends where it falls. Yes.
So a lot of the things you're talking about are not in what we traditionally think of as economic development. They're not tied to a specific job creation project. It's Joseph has been cited, for example, I'm not using that disparagingly.
Anybody,
say
sure.
Small City X gets told by DEQ that their water system is not up to snuff and they have to fix it.
Mm-hmm.
This would be a place where they could come and get a loan to do that, maybe bonding, but they don't have a bond rating or the ability to do that, so you can issue the bonds for them?
We can for larger projects. What we're looking to do, and we haven't used this mechanism for about 6 or 7 years, is we can now take our loans that we award and package them and sell bonds for that.
Yeah, you just call it an umbrella loan program?
Yeah. Yeah, so we're gonna start doing that, obviously, because there's demand on lottery, and we want to look at other ways to capture funds. But yes, we can also, if it's a larger project, we can bond that out individually, and we have a better rating, of course.
The expectation there is that it will be you're borrowing the money through a bond, but then you're making a loan to the community, and they then are expected to repay it and
correct
service that bond. I assume that you're part of the advantage to them is, I guess there are a few advantages. One, they don't have to pay for issuance costs.
Correct.
And that's expensive, bond mm-hmm. counsel and all that. And I also think that doesn't show up on their credit report.
If they have a credit. report.
Well, but it probably doesn't make a lot of difference to them, but in the accounting sense, it doesn't count. It doesn't count the same way as if they went out directly.
Sense.
Whether that's material
that I'm
not or not,
sure
I don't know. But yeah,
I could certainly find out. One area where we do have grants, we call them forgivable loans because there's a clawback. Most of the grants that we do give in all of our programs at Business Oregon have a clawback to them. So if you don't meet certain standards that we set on your creation of jobs or what have you, we get the money back. Is we have a forgivable loan program for job creation. So that ties it directly into economic development, whereas a community, say, could borrow funds from us, or in this case, a forgivable loan to build out, you know, a street to the site. And then if so many jobs are created by that business that's going to locate there, we can forgive the money based on that. Hey, what happened? Any idea? I know it was there.
That's a good question.
I'll give it a second.
I got it.
This technology.
Disappeared?
It disappeared.
No, it's there.
I've got it on mine.
There. And if not, I can just keep going. We'll... Thanks. Huh. Interesting. I don't know that.
Senator Monroe's feeling special because it goes up on his.
Yeah. Is it coming up there?
Yeah.
You guys
yeah.
all huddled to get now. Just.
Special public works spot.
Is there a place where this would be, Patrick? Chris Cummings just, probably be the obvious one. And a place for this?
Oh, like right down there. You want to, W will come and help you with it, I think.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on with that.
Can you close this?
Close that. Is that it's open? Yeah. Aha. Uh-huh. Thank you.
There you go.
I get lost without pictures. What I wanted to point out to you with this slide is that Special Public Works, as I said, is our most versatile fund. What we use Special Public Works for is provide match of our other programs. So we have a wastewater program that's part of Special Public Works. We have a safe drinking water program. We have community development block grants. We use this funding when we come to the legislature and ask for funding to match those other programs. For instance, the safe drinking water, we get about $12 million a year. With the 20% match required, we can use from the feds, we can use Special Public Works to match that. So it serves not only the programs or projects that people come to us for, it's in other areas as well. Give you an idea of where Special Public Works goes. As you can see from this slide, about 49% or 49 projects go out to rural areas. And that's basically why you see that most of our money goes out to rural areas is because, as I mentioned, the smaller rural areas don't have the money, right? The urban areas usually can afford these things on their own. Figure I'd bring a few examples. This is a recent project of ours, and I'm not bringing this example just because it's the largest project. And why I took the train station is because I didn't have a picture of the water facility. So I figured I'd throw that out there, and it looked kind of cool. We funded the city of Lebanon through both our safe drinking water program and our special public works program to the tune of $28 million, or almost $24 million. To build a new water treatment plant and a new raw water intake from the river. They were using aligned with Albany, and they needed to switch to their own facility, so we were able to loan them money for that project. What we're seeing, and why I bring this up, is that during the recession, we spent a lot of money on planning grants and planning loans for communities to do these sort of systems and other systems. And now that we're obviously the economy is good, they're taking more of a risk. So we're seeing larger and larger projects as we move forward.
So Chris, in this example, do they have to pay the entire $24 million back, or just the $11 million special public works?
No, they have to pay it all back. There was a portion of the grant or of this package. I'd have to remember what it was. That was about $1 million in loans to distressed communities, we call it. We have different packages. And that safe drinking water, if I remember correctly, was at 1% interest. So they do pay most of it back, and they use their rates to pay that back.
Okay.
Or other mechanisms that they may have. Usually it's their
collection rates. So even though, if I understood you correctly, the $13 million is federal money that comes in?
Mostly federal money.
But
sure.
You can, once you get that, you can get that, you can revolve that and build that fund?
Yes.
Okay.
And from a technical standpoint, once it gets paid back to us, it's considered other funds in our budget. So it loses some of its restrictions that it had before, and then we can meet more community needs.
So what's the interest rate?
It depends on the community. If we have what we call a disadvantaged community, it's 1%. It can be as low as 1% for that safe drinking water. And we'll talk about safe drinking water coming up here. Another thing that was a little bit different is we funded this fish passage and electrical generation system for the Deschutes Valley Water District. They had some compliance issue with fish passage, mm-hmm. so they needed to create a new system here, whereas they could also generate power, so it'll increase their improve their revenues back to the district, and hence and they can also use that to pay us. So it's not just water and wastewater and those sort of projects that we do with this. We've also funded projects at the a large building project at the Coos Bay Airport District and Albany's downtown street improvements, where they pay back with urban renewal funds. So it's not just that what you think of as infrastructure. The Water Wastewater Fund, even though it's a separate fund, is part of the Special Public Works Fund program. When we come ask the legislature for money for Special Public Works, like we did last session and probably every session, is that money also funds this program. And this program helps fund projects where there's a compliance issue for communities. One of the things we've learned and we're looking at recently is that there has to be a compliance issue. But what that means is we're rewarding communities that may not maintain their system. If you have a community that maintains the system or is trying to get ahead of that compliance curve, we can't fund them with this program. So we're looking to see if we can make some changes to that, but obviously that'll take a little time.
Is that Oregon statute?
That wasn't statute, right?
It isn't statute.
It isn't statute.
Okay, so you're looking for more flexibility. Will we see that in 19?
We're putting together what we're going to be looking for in 19 now, because we have quite a few things that we're going to be looking for, so it could be one of those.
Okay.
This, again, offers below market rates, just like all of our programs, sometimes down to 1%. And communities that are disadvantaged can get grants up to $750,000, depending on different factors within their community.
So it's one of the questions I should ask is, all of these, they're loans and they're coming back. Does the revolve on that, does it pay for the administration?
So that's a great question. It pays for some of the administration. The revolve on it pays for some of the administration, but we also use this fund, the Special Public Works Fund, to pay for those matching programs that I had mentioned. So it doesn't cover all of that. So it's not a self-sufficient program yet, and hence why we have to come back to the legislature. When it increases in size enough, which would be obviously years down the road, then it would be self-sufficient, but it's not there.
So these, so far, it sounds like all of these are loans to one level or another of government, Port
yes,
District or city.
So far.
So the default rate, I imagine, is pretty low.
It is. Like the Special Public Works Fund, the default rate right now is set by the Infrastructure Finance Authority is 3.5%, and that can go out over 30 years.
Default level? The default of the loans is extreme.
Default of the loan, yeah.
Yeah.
You mean, do we? Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
I'm sorry, no, I'm saying.
So do we have
what
default?
I was trying to say was that because it's to governments, my guess is you get the, it's not like running a private portfolio, which I think that's part of your thing too. You expect some loan loss on that.
Right.
With governments, you probably don't.
We have very few defaults in our. We have one in the portfolio of a couple hundred loans right now. Generally, what we can do is negotiate with a city,
yeah.
And if we have to postpone or you know,
right.
We don't necessarily want to put the term at 30 years, because if there is an issue, from we can move it from 25 to 30 and lower their rates.
Okay. So.
Same with wastewater program as Special Public Works. Most of the money goes to rural areas, as we discussed why. Between Special Public Works and water wastewater, in the last biennium, we spent $45 million a year, so $90 million approximately in loans and grants that we put out in the street to local communities. Prior to that, the previous biennium, it was down, I believe, around $50 million. So you can see how that economy changed and the increase went up, and things just get older, so they need to repair them. This is a compliance issue to City of Seneca, which is out not far from Burns, I should say, in eastern Oregon, not far terms. They had a compliance issue where they had leaking into the river, so we were able to help fund them with new ponds for their project. Again, the picture, they don't have many pictures of the wastewater facilities. Is it?
It's an old wigwam burner. You don't see many of those anymore.
The other program that is one of our larger programs is the Safe Drinking Water Program. This is the federal program. And this is where a compliance issue isn't necessary, where we can work on water and wastewater and sewer systems. This is in compliance, you can see there with the rates, but it's in compliance with the Oregon Health Authority, whereas they're the applicant for the federal government. We met, and they may rank projects, but we manage all the projects. Mm. Building the project itself and the administration and so on. I forgot what I was going to say, so I won't say it. Same with the safe drinking water. As you can see, that's the last biennium. We did over 100 projects for roughly $77 million in that fund. The last biennium, we heard from the feds that was the best biennium we've had in years. So. Baker City, they had an issue with contamination in their water, and we were able to loan them funds to get a new treatment plant in place, which, again, when I talk about economic development, it's if you don't have those systems in place, nobody's going to move there, right, particularly if you have a contamination. To give you a difference in communities, this is City of Merrill, which we just awarded $3 million. For a water system. They need a new water tower. That water tower there is, I think it was 90 years old, or give or take. It was old. They said it was the oldest in the state, but who knows? Part of the reason they needed it there, and the City of Merrill is quite small, it's down the California border, is they had a Les Schwab that wanted to open there, and they didn't have the pressure to be able to, for that Les Schwab to be able to open there. So, again, when I tie it to economic development, that's how we're starting to look at our programs more, as if you just need money, is there a way where we can tie it into the community's economy? City of Banks, I just wanted to show you the project because it was a smaller project. They have these water lines set up throughout the town. They're smaller water lines. They're not necessarily ideal, and they're going to be replacing those. So brownfields, another program that we have. We have both federal and state funding for brownfields. For those of you who may not be familiar with brownfields, they're contaminated or suspected contaminated sites. It could be anything from an old mill, which we have plenty of, to a gas station or your local dry cleaner, which are notorious for contamination. We have a state fund, as you can see on the board, and we have the second fund, the Oregon Brownfields Cleanup Fund, is a federal fund where we provide some match. These, where we can work with brownfields is we have, again, it's primarily loans, but we do have grants, particularly for phase one and phase two assessments, initial assessments of properties. But we can give these to both public and private sector entities. The key here is that you didn't cause the contamination as the owner. Nobody wants to give you money if you went out back and poured the oil in the ground. So that's one thing. We have a brownfield staff member who's an expert in this, and actually she's very keen on going around the state and working with different communities, working with our businesses as well, encouraging them not to buy a property until they do the necessary paperwork that protects them from liability. So we work with quite a few districts and private sector industries on this. This, I thought, was a bit interesting. These are, in Oregon, are known contaminated sites. There's about 450 known contaminated sites. There's an estimated 13,500 contaminated sites. The state really doesn't go ahead and do a survey, because once we do a survey, if the state were to declare something a brownfield, it's almost akin to lessening the value of that property, and that there's some issues with doing that. But these are known sites where either people came in, or there was a complaint, or they were abandoned. As you can see, they're all over the state. It's a big issue. And one of the biggest issues about many of these brownfields is their owners could be absent. They're not paying taxes into local property tax. They have no workers there and so on. And you don't always get the highest and best use out of that property. And many of them are within the urban growth boundary, right? So here's industrial land that we could be accessing, in many cases industrial land, that we're not because of the cost of cleanup. So where these programs come in, it's kind of like most of our other industrial programs. It's a chicken and egg thing. Does the developer want to invest into this site? Does a new business want to buy the site without knowing anything? So we can bridge that gap with helping with some of that financing.
Just give you how onerous is it on a business who wants to redevelop, you know, a former dry cleaner site or something like that?
So I'm not the expert in it, but I would say if there's a former dry cleaner site with contamination, it would be pretty onerous because a lot of times it leaks into the groundwater. Mm-hmm. But in many cases, what our brownfield staff tells me is that it's just the requirement of getting that phase one. Sometimes sites you don't have to clean up to do business. You have to clean them up to a certain level. Mm-hmm. So if you want to open a new dry cleaner or a gas station, you probably wouldn't have to clean it up to a level that you would have to clean it up to if you were going to make housing, if you will. Mm-hmm. From basically what I get out of it is there aren't many sites that are the same, kind of like snowflakes, right?
They're all different, yeah.
This is just an example. Yes,
Senator, how much money do we put into that program?
In 2015 session or 16, we were awarded $7 million, and we'll probably be back in 2019 with an additional request.
Not much.
Not much in the terms of.
So it's just kind of getting started.
Right.
It's been a long time. We're still not much into it.
Just to give you an idea, and of course I picked a really nice shiny one here. This is a site in Hillsboro where we had $300,000 loans amongst tons of other money into this project, where we worked with the city to clean up a site that was an old lumber yard and a dry cleaner and a hodgepodge of other properties, and they built what you see on the right, which is a mixed-use building. But imagine now that building is full, there's businesses in there, and how the community changed from businesses that were necessarily vacant. So industrial lands is another program we have, and I heard you were interested in industrial lands. Mm-hmm. So we have a few programs that we work with industrial lands. Right now we don't really have money in those programs. We're looking at ideas to maybe use our special public works fund to see how we can do things, or we'll be back to the legislature, of course, with a request for that, depending. We have an industrial development projects of state significance. That's a program that's relatively unknown. If you're going to build a specialty project, maybe if it's cross-laminated timber in Portland, and not to pick on Portland, but it could be any town, right, USA or Oregon, and you don't have the construction expertise in your city, we can write a letter that's, depending on what it is, a program of state significance, and then the state inspectors can go out and work that project for you. So, for instance, if you're a small town and you have a large manufacturing facility come in, and you're not familiar with that facility, and it's, say, I don't know, 1 million square feet, you only have one construction official in town or a part-time construction official, you may not have the capacity to know all those laws right up front. So that's where the state can get involved.
So that's not for, in some way, helping finance the development?
That one's not, and I have one for that we'll get into. We have
this is just technical assistance.
That was just a technical assistance program. We have regionally significant industrial areas, regionally significant industrial sites, and then shovel-ready certification. And what I'll get into is the certification of the sites. Right now, across the state, there are 93 certified sites. What certified sites means is that they go through our program, or they can pay us, if whether it's a city or a private entity, can pay us to do some studies, and we'll determine that a site is ready to be constructed within 180 days. So in other words, land use approvals, or at least those that that would be longer to occur or in place, utilities are in place and such that it would take less than 180 days to get to the site and allow you to construct, and any other zoning issues are taken care of, et cetera.
Wetlands,
yes. It would be everything that's needed to have a site that can start construction, whereas a developer can start construction in 180 days. The average certification for us to work through, and we use a consultant who will work with other departments as necessary, and local government, et cetera, is around $6,000 to $10,000 for that to occur. Once it's certified, you would then recertify every year. The recertification process is pretty easy. You're saying nothing changed on the property, and then you're recertified. If somebody came in there and dumped a bunch of contamination onto the property, well, then you're probably not 180 days out anymore.
It's an observation. I don't know where it's accurate. Last time I looked at this, which has been a while, most of those sites were in rural areas. And while that was great, the question is, did it make that much difference? They were not in places where you're normally going to see. I shouldn't say it that way. The demand for development is pretty limited.
Mm-hmm. There could be a few reasons for that. One is that the rural areas may have been particularly clean and flat and ready to go for that certification, whereas in the urban areas, they may be more brownfield, or if it's in the valley here, it may be more wetlands and so on. So a lot of what had happened with these 93 sites is that the low-hanging fruit got picked off right away, and now what we're seeing, and it's represented by our key performance measure, whereas we have one site for the biennium, or one site per year for the biennium, which ideally we can get more than, are sites that are more, they're a little harder to get to that 180 days. The other thing is frankly, with this process, is we don't have money in the fund for that, for this certification. So earlier on, we had money in this fund, whereas we could pay for cities at $6,000 to $10,000 to go ahead and certify these sites, or help them with money to do the necessary legwork to get it to that certification period. Whereas now we don't have that funding available, so we're reevaluating the program. We will be over the next few months or 6 months and see how it should look that can better serve our communities.
We've had these for a long time, and I guess the question, you know, seeking professional opinion is, has it made a difference?
Has it made a difference? I think in certain areas it's made a difference. I think also it's something that we really would need to investigate further to get some numbers on the ground. But certainly in the metro area, it's made a difference where we have sites. And now that you see the demand for sites going up, businesses, it's win or lose if a business or an industry comes along and they want a site quickly if we have it. Has it made a difference in some of those rural areas? I would say less so. I think it's difficult. There's more difficulties to attracting business in those areas, as we all know. What we do need, though, is there's a shortage of sites available in the metro area and the valley, particularly large sites, and that's probably where we need to focus some of our attention and put our efforts into.
That's fine. I don't want to interrupt your program, but
No, I'm fine.
But the real, for me, the thing that we hear a lot in the valley is that from the land use side, where there's all kinds of acres of land available, but in a lot of, when you look at that, most of those are 3-5 acres or less. Not a problem with those particularly, but if you're looking at some of the larger clients that I think communities salivate over, they don't have the land for that, and we've never really addressed that. And it's been hard, you know, where I think the department has been remiss is when we get into that industrial lands inventory that's required under the land use side. You really haven't given the policymakers, either local or the state, good information on what the demand for that is. And it's one of the things I hope at some point we're getting from you is just sort of a, it'd be nice to have an annual sort of assessment of here's who came knocking at the door and here's the ones we couldn't serve because, whatever the because is.
I think that would certainly be a valuable input for any community, and it could be leading from that because to, well, yeah, your property is you know, at the back of your community and you have to drive through all these residential streets. Or you have these brownfields that could meet that. How can we help you clean them up? Yeah, I think the input at that level is most important for us.
Yeah, I think we don't hear enough of that from a policy perspective, really a good idea of, because you're the front door, mm-hmm. you know, the people, whether it's the community, whatever, we don't hear enough from you about what is the level of activity request and why are they going someplace else?
Right.
And what's the deficit that we have that we might help you address?
No, I think that would be a mechanism we could set up. Certainly, you know, we have somebody in every region of the state, so it's certainly it's an easy enough, valuable tool for them, for communities. The 36 pre-certified sites, that just means that they went through the certification process, but they can't meet 180 days. So we give them a list of what you have to do. They can figure out the cost of what it is to get to that 180-day. And then they can choose to do that or not. Intakes are just our application, and then we have one right now in the process, as I mentioned, the reasons why. This is a program that was, I believe it was passed in 2015. It's regionally significant industrial sites, mm-hmm. and it's something that we, the legislation with some technical fixes was passed the last session, and we're working on right now to get out to communities, building the rules. But what this does is it allows a developer, whether it's a city or a private entity, as we see it right now, to enter into or be declared a RISA site. They would apply to the department with certain standards. And if they are a RISA site, any business that comes on that site, and if it's in a rural area, creates more than 25 jobs, and in an urban area, more than 50, those income taxes from that would go back to the developer to recapture for the cost of developing the property. So, for instance, if you're that is a big issue for industrial lands. It's the chicken or the egg. Do I put all this money into this property or do I not? Now, this doesn't wholly address it because you still need that business to locate there or businesses, but at least it's an incentive if you know you have a business that you're decreasing the cost for that business and decreasing the cost for the developer itself.
The money doesn't go to the developer, though. It goes to the city, doesn't it?
The sponsor would be the city.
The sponsor,
yes.
City.
Not to the developer. You're correct.
Only to the extent of covering whatever the investment was.
Right. And so all of the programs need, or all of this, the RISA sites need a public sponsor.
We did that, Bill.
So we have a lot of interest in it right now because it is such a good program, particularly if you're a city government, right? And we'll see where that goes. But again, we're in the rulemaking process, so hopefully early next year we'll have all that settled and have some folks in the program. We did have one that was a Troutdale site for Trip 2 that entered in before the technical changes last time, and we'll see how that goes. To my knowledge, the tax reimbursements haven't started flowing back yet.
There's a high level of risk for a city to get involved in it. They have to feel pretty good that they're making the investment, which they still are on the hook to pay back.
Right. They are still on the hook to pay back. And for some cities, what we're looking at is using that special public works fund, again, depending how much money is in there, and we can make a loan. Can we make a patient loan? Can we, you know, mm-hmm. you don't have to pay back until 2 years until you realize that. So it's all things we have to look at, and, of course, the balance of our funds and so on to make sure we can do it.
Yeah, when we put that the concept together, the idea was that we have that barrier there, so not every little community, maybe some of those rural ones that have that, wouldn't necessarily do that unless they really had something that was going to happen.
Mm-hmm. And that's probably what the case will be, or they're in such a situation that they know, maybe they don't have a hook on the line, but they know that, right, we have this awesome space, there's not enough space in this area, et cetera.
What we were trying to prevent, when I was working with it, was in the 60s and 70s, the Federal Economic Development Administration had a program similar to this where they developed the heck out of industrial parks in rural areas throughout the United States, most of which are still waiting for someone to come in.
Right.
So we wanted to make sure that we didn't encourage that, but did provide an avenue for those that, where you could get something done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, and we see some of those industrial sites across the state, right, where they've been developed and maybe not so well maintained anymore because nobody's using them. But.
Okay.
So just quickly, the other programs that I wasn't going to go into depth in unless you have a question about them, I'm happy to, is our seismic program. Last session, we were provided with $200 million to provide seismic retrofits to schools and emergency service buildings, fire stations, hospitals with trauma centers, police stations, et cetera. We give grants in that program up to $2.5 million now for retrofits. Our ports programs, we have loans in there, some grants. Broadband planning, that's a big topic right now. We just developed with the Governor's Strategic Reserve Funds, developed a pilot program that I believe the RFP went out on last week, where we'll be offering planning and engineering grants and maybe some infrastructure grants. The program size right now is $500,000, so it's not a lot of work. But part of calling it and it being a pilot is to test the waters. What is the real need out there? We hear all the time that rural communities and even urban communities need broadband access. But ideally, this will help us get a better picture.
I'm real familiar with that one from my time at the Public Utility Commission. Senator Riley would be very clear on that.
Yeah.
One of the things that I hope we're cautious about is not getting into too much competition where there's good private sector involvement. I mean, now you have our major telecommunications company that's trying to get to a giga every place that makes financial sense, as is the two cable companies, which are very good, but again, they're going to miss out on some of those rural areas particularly.
And our broadband
staff. And there's a question of how much, if you're setting out on a ranch, 15 miles from the nearest 5,000 town, does it really make sense to run gigabit service out there?
Right. So ideally, it wouldn't be. It would be a community service type of issue, and it would be where somebody else isn't picking up the cost. Because, again, as you mentioned, we don't want to compete with somebody. Ideally, private sector monies get used and not ours.
It's a tough one.
It is. Yes, I've worked on that for quite a while. And mm-hmm. I'm sure you may not know the answer, but we used to have a lot of dark fiber in the state.
Still do.
And we still do, I think. And I want to see us start finding a way to put nodes on that and start using that dark fiber.
And you're absolutely correct, Senator. I don't know the answer to that. But we can always get you the answer, or we
no,
do
that's
have
okay.
a broadband.
I know the answer. Thank you.
Cool. Well, that's good.
Good.
How do all these programs occur? People don't just come knocking our doors, although they do sometimes. But it's a lot of hard work putting our programs together and putting packages together for folks. And Robert Alt here, he's our business and community services manager, and he manages our regional development officers, et cetera, and he's going to talk about that. And you can tell me this one.
Sure. Chair Beyer, committee members, my name is Robert Alt. I manage business and community development for Business Oregon. As Chris mentioned, we do have an array of programs at Business Oregon. However, the programs can only work if we're effective at the delivery of those programs. What are we striving for? We are striving for a regional approach. We believe that different regions have different needs. Regionally based staff, we think it's important that living and working outside of Salem helps our staff stay in touch with the needs of those regions. A can-do attitude. It may seem simple, but we do try and attempt to move every project forward, knowing that sometimes we can't. If we can't, we're very clear to try and find resources or funding for projects that we can't move forward. Straight answers in a timely fashion. Sometimes those answers are no, but I feel like the people that we work for deserve those clear answers, and it's something we really are aiming for. We hope to move at the speed of business. We strive to move so quickly that we'll never slow your project down. We don't always hit that mark, but it's something to aim for, and I think it's really important. Our vision statement says that prosperity is for all Oregonians. We do believe in it, that a true statewide approach is important, but a regional focus is really, really critical to carry that out. We base this on 12 regions, as you see on the screen. Each region is served by a regional development officer. The regional development officer is really the face of the agency for both infrastructure and business projects. If you have a need, that is the first point of contact for all of those needs. The RDO, the regional development officer, is ably assisted by regional project managers. We have six of those. They really are implementation. They implement those projects. They also provide a great deal of assistance, technical assistance, one-on-one assistance to sometimes very, very small communities that just don't have the capacity to move those projects forward. Easier in a larger municipality, but if you have 42 citizens and a part-time city recorder, it can be a little daunting looking at the hoops that you have to jump through, especially for federal programs. We have an array of finance officers that help with both public finance for municipal projects and also business financing. We have a whole array of experts, program experts, internally who can help us decide what resources we should channel towards any given project. That includes, as Chris mentioned, business development, seismic rehab of schools and safety and public safety facilities, industrial lands. We have experts in global trade, foreign direct investment, and also in the recruitment of businesses. I don't want to leave out infrastructure projects, and I'd like to talk briefly about an example of a regional approach to outreach to communities that I think is really powerful. It's called a one-stop. A one-stop basically is bringing together community members, state and federal agency funders, financial experts, and technical expertise, such as civil engineers. We convene that group oftentimes in the communities. They can come to Salem, but actually I think it's more effective if we go to the communities. We convene a group and we work through their project. There's oftentimes several different funding streams that they can use, sometimes state funds that we shepherd, but also federal funds. And so we have DEQ, we have rural development, and other funders in the room. So what that does, and I think it's very powerful, is it graphically shows community leaders what's the cost of that project, and also, really importantly, what's the best deal that we can get. If there's several sources of funding, does Business Oregon have the best source of funds, or can you get a better deal from DEQ or from USDARD? So it shows them what the least cost is. It also really graphically shows them what's the burden of bearing the cost of the project. Oftentimes for infrastructure projects, that's going to reflect in an increase in their rates. And any community leader, I think, wants to be able to go back and with certainty talk to the people in the community about how much is this going to raise the rates for your water and your sewage. It's really important. I think, a really powerful tool. They, as I said, present clear financing options, and I think they really help simplify that process, make it clear and understandable. We do work with an array of cities from, you know, large and very sophisticated to, as I said earlier, very small and with capacity that, you know, is limited. So it's our, I think, a clear role for us to step in and provide assistance so that they can move those important projects forward. I think that the regional approach that we endorse, backed by all of the agency resources, is very powerful. I spoke last week to a representative of a federal agency. He works in multi-state, he has a multi-state area, and he talked about the real benefit in Oregon of having one point person that he can go to when he wants to get things done. It was an unsolicited comment, but I think it really points to the fact that having that regional development officer with all of the resources of the agency in the regions is a really effective and efficient way to operate.
So how do you contrast that with the governor's regional solutions managers, which are pretty much arrayed the same way?
Yeah, I think that they work in a complementary fashion. And I mean, on any given project, I think we work very closely with them and wouldn't get where we need to be without their help.
We Senator, we manage too is not we do larger projects where we'll bring in other funding sources, but a lot of our work is managing the programs that we have too. So the RSTs don't necessarily manage those programs.
So these are also the same people who, if you had someone who wanted to come in and put a server farm someplace in state, they would be the ones that worked with that company as well?
Yes, the regional development officer.
And if it's somebody from out of state, we have recruitment officers as well. Mm-hmm. So they deal on recruitment deals.
So that really concludes my presentation. I'm happy to answer any questions you have.
Sounds like you're spread pretty thin.
I think that they're quite busy. But actually, we have 12 regional development officers in the new transformation, new iteration of the agency. We actually added several regional development officers because we felt that they were stretched very much too thin.
And they're living in the regions, not in Salem?
Yeah, there are no... Everyone is out in the region. There are none that are based in Salem.
Except the Salem rep.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They get around. They're at everything. But I see them a lot. They're very active.
That's always good to hear.
Questions? Senators? Thank you very much.
Chair, Senators, thank you.
What's next?
Now it's time for a real ID.
Real ID.
Good afternoon, Chair Beyer and members of the committee. Amy Joyce from the Department of Transportation, and we were asked to come in today and give a report on Real ID and compliance efforts. So I'll start out with just some quick refresher background on what we're talking about. Real ID recall is the federal law that sets standards for states' driver's license and ID cards. 42 specific elements in 3 general categories, and those are the reliability of the underlying information that a customer provides to us, secure procedures and personnel, and then the security of the plastic card itself. The penalty for not complying from the federal government is not the usual withholding of federal funds. Instead, if a state is not compliant, that state's cards cannot be used for federal identification purposes. So nuclear facilities, military bases, some federal buildings, and then most interesting to most people, eventually, the inability to use that card to board commercial domestic flights to be able to get through TSA.
So if I don't have a card, they can't put me on a federal jury?
Go ahead and get that Real ID compliant card, Senator Beyer. You can still, if you're a defendant, you can enter the federal courthouse. If you're a potential juror, you actually can, I think. So for some purposes, they'll let you in the door, and for others, perhaps not.
How will they know if I'm there legally?
So as you all know, Oregon is not currently compliant with Real ID. We do have an extension, which Tom will talk about in a minute. The primary reasons that Oregon is not compliant are two. One is that when people show us their identity documents, their legal presence documents, their residency documents, we don't scan and store those for 7 years. That's a big requirement of Real ID. The second is that we don't take those documents and then verify them through various federal systems that were set up for Real ID. We actually do that today with your Social Security number. We do verify that, but there are other systems for verifying passports and birth certificates, and we aren't set up to use those today.
Do they work?
Sure. They do.
Mostly.
Yeah. So I'm having a little fun here.
Yeah, sure. I'm going to have a little fun too. Isn't one of the main reasons that we aren't compliant is because we told you not to do it?
Well, we did change that.
I mean, and Senator Riley, that was the policy of the state of Oregon until this session.
Yes.
We were told that to change direction. So, yes, that is, we are not compliant because we were told not to be, but the
got
state.
Got a late start because of that.
Yeah. Right. That's very true.
It's okay with me.
He's just saying. He's just saying.
Yeah.
That said,
it's not your fault. It's ours.
No, we knew that.
Yeah.
in the 2017 session, the legislature did pass Senate Bill 374, which directed DMV to begin issuing or offering the option for a real ID compliant card. So under Senate Bill 374.
Well, I mean, part of it was your IT system, without being upgraded, was not capable of doing all that. But when we came last time, you were in, had the approval to move ahead with the IT upgrade, which will put you in a position where you can comply. Is that, am I saying that right?
Well,
and this is Senator Riley's bailiwick.
Chair Beyer, certainly the authorization to move ahead with our service transformation program will make it much much simpler, much cheaper to comply with Real ID. And so you're correct. Moving forward with our service transformation program, and the operative date of July 2020 that was put into the Real ID bill, Senate Bill 374, that date was intentional to sync up with the implementation of the service transformation program and the ability to issue driver's licenses and ID cards under that new system. So at the same time we're rolling out the new driver system in July 2020, we'll also begin that issuance of this new product, the optional Real ID compliant cards. So really that's your questions kind of got me to the end of my presentation, I think. Tom gets to give you good news about extensions.
Do you have a question?
No, I'm waiting.
Okay. Chair Beyer, members of the committee, my name is Tom McClellan, DMV Administrator with the Department of Transportation. With the passage of Senate Bill 374, we were able to get another extension through October of this year, mm-hmm. and then Governor Brown signed a letter September 29th requesting a further extension, which we got response back on October 16th from the Department of Homeland Security that we had received another year of extension. So now we're into October of 2018 with that extension. And we're in good company. There are at least 16 other states that are also in the same status. There's another, I think it's 11 or 12 that are under review, including some territories, American Samoa and Guam, and those are also part of this as well. So there's a lot of states and territories that are not compliant today, but have received extensions or additional time to comply. And many are moving forward diligently to achieve compliance. Our neighbors to the south are have ambitions to achieve compliance by January of next year. They're awaiting some feedback from the Department of Homeland Security, but they are working very diligently to try to 19, meet the final
18 or 19.
They're trying to get it by next year. I think they're close enough that they may get an extension or approval at that point. So we received the extension. In doing so, we had to identify a more specific plan of action to achieve compliance. So in that request for the extension, we identified the deficiencies that we have today and some timelines and some milestones for many of those steps, taking us to the July 2020 date that's operative in Senate Bill 374. Two major projects that we have going on that will enable compliance. The first really is our driver license issuance replacement system. We're in the process right now of replacing all our hardware, software, our facial recognition capability, and the actual cards that we issue by next year. Around the summer time of next year, we'll be rolling out to all 60 offices new equipment for issuing licenses. In doing that, we'll add some additional security provisions to the card itself, which will up the ante a little bit from where we are today. We'll also have the ability to identify both compliant and non-compliant cards once we are able to complete all those processes that are part of that. So that there'll be space reserved on the new cards to print either a black star for a compliant, Real ID compliant card, or small verbiage, not for Real ID Act. So if the person chooses to apply for the compliant card, they'll get the black star, which then a TSA agent or someone at a federal secure facility can look for on all cards, Oregon cards. Or they'll see that writing on the card, or no writing if it's a current issued card, that would not be accepted at that point. So that project is moving ahead, and we've got that identified in our implementation plan. The other big one is this, as Amy said, our service transformation program, our modernization of our computer systems.
Our first rollout will be our vehicle systems and some core, you know, point-of-sale type capabilities by January of 2019. So in about 14 months from now, that'll be our first rollout. Followed immediately after that, our driver systems, which is where the real ID pieces will fit. And that connectivity to these national systems that Amy referenced. We'll be able to do that. The current schedule is July 1st of 2020. So all this is syncing up as long as we can stay on schedule with those projects and be able to offer the cards to those who want to pay a little extra money and provide the documents that will be required that others would not have to provide.
So I guess I have two questions. One is, what's your level of confidence that the system, when you're done, will be secure? And second one is, what do you think the cost for the Black Star card is going to be?
Senator Beyer, I don't have a good answer on the cost part of that. We will
ballpark.
I don't, and I hazard to venture a guess at this point. But we understand our charge is to recover our costs. Mm-hmm. So if there's any additional time and additional system expenses for us in order to provide that upgraded card, then we will recover that with an increase. I think during the session we may have said like $5 or $10 was our guess, but it was a guess, purely a guess. I want to base it on some hard numbers.
Okay.
And as we get closer, we'll be able to provide that to you and to others as well. Part of the Senate Bill 374 is a communication plan. And that communication plan, among other things, is to identify the difference in cost and the difference in usability between a compliant card and a non-compliant card so that people are fully informed when that date comes around to that choice. On the security side, it's an important provision for us. We work with the state data centers, the state CIO, their office, making sure that we are following all the network protocols that are necessary. We're working with a vendor that has a good track record and understands that security around this whole area. Their experience has been in revenue taxation systems and DMV systems in other parts of the country, successfully installed, and they understand that security is a big part of the work that we do as state agencies like this. So we'll do the best we can to make sure it's
installed. So once we get to being in a position where we can issue the Black Star card, will it then be possible for someone who just wants to come in and doesn't care about that, just wants a regular driver card, not to have to bring all that other stuff in?
Senator Beyer, absolutely.
Gee,
absolutely.
There may be a lot of people who work for you who just don't want that Black Star card.
They can get a passport, right? They can still get a passport and some use that to get on an airplane, right?
You can do it now. I'm talking about all your work. Really.
Some of the people who work for you.
Happy. Yeah,
in many of our estimates of how many people might want or need to get this card, we've used a number about 30% of people because they don't need access to a military base or a nuclear power plant. They don't plan to fly, or if they do plan to fly, they have other forms of identification that they know will be accepted.
Like a passport?
Like a passport or a passport card. There are other military-type documents that can be used. Yeah. Not everyone can obtain, but there's a lot of other choices as well. So we don't assume that everyone's going to want or choose to buy this card.
In some ways, it'll make your staffs at the front counter work a little more difficult.
It does make it a little more complicated.
If they don't come in, I guess the answer is, well, if you don't have all that, I can get you your driver's license if you pass the test, but I can't give you...
It won't have a Black Star on it.
Black Star card. That in itself would be a new nomenclature, the Black Star card. Yes. Particularly, I see no reason. I see the reason to put the Black Star. I don't know why you'd put anything else on the rest of the cards.
Yeah, it's just one of the 42 provisions that you identify both a compliant and a non-compliant card.
We told them we would do that.
Chair Beyer, we did. It's a mandate, and we worked with them to get the verbiage down as slim
small
as we could get it, but we worked on that. But it's an absolute mandate.
Could you use the acronym?
We have about the shortest description of any state that's been approved so far.
I'm just giving you a bad time.
There's been a space between real and ID. We were just running it all together. So very, very small. So we provided... We provided the implementation plan with some milestones. We committed to quarterly reports, which they will let us know what that is going to look like here in the next few months. So sometime next year, we'll provide our first quarterly report. We've committed to provide input or information to them on any milestones that we achieve or any issues we have with our schedule that might cause something to slip that we will let them know. Okay. We fully expect to apply for additional extensions. So September of 2018 and September of 2019, we'll be asking for additional extensions. And based on the approval that we got from them last month, I fully expect if we show progress, we show our commitment and diligence in following through, that we will continue to receive these extensions.
Okay. I guess the most important question I'm telling you is the indication you have from them is the approach we're taking is acceptable.
Chair Bauer, yes, that is what we're receiving. And the devil will be in the details as we put our compliance package together and we actually start providing examples of forms and documents and security provisions that we have in place. They may find something that doesn't quite meet the letter of the law and we'll have to make some adjustments. But from what we've been told so far, we believe we're on the right track.
More concerned about the security from their end rather than our end. You got a question.
Are there any states that just said, we're not doing this, and are they already non-compliant?
Chair Beyer, Senator Thompson, if you'd asked me that a year ago, I would have had a pretty long list of states that just said forget it.
Okay.
But
including
we
us.
Were actually the last state to submit information that we had removed the prohibitions in our statutes. It was remarkable, actually, how many states changed course. Once they realized Homeland Security was very serious about these deadlines that they'd laid out. And so there are no other states right now that have explicit prohibitions to compliance.
Okay. Chair Beyer and Senator Thompson, in the materials that we submitted, there's a map, which we usually attach, that shows each state whether they're compliant, whether, like us, we are under extension, or like a few other states, they're still being reviewed by Homeland Security to see if they'll be granted an extension. But everybody has put in for an extension saying that they will eventually comply.
It's okay. They're not letting anybody into the country anymore anyway. All right. Other questions? We've kind of beat this one up.
I believe we've completed our report, so unless you have other questions, we'll
you're doing a good job.
Get out of your way.
With all of our badgering, you're doing a good job. And hopefully you get a computer system that works, but
absolutely.
We're going to leave Senator Riley to be
I'll badger them on Thursday.
Thursday, that's right.
Thank you very much. Colleagues, I think we hit the end of the agenda.
Unless you want to discuss committee bills, Mr. Chair.
Committee bills. We have, we can talk about the ones that I know of, and I don't have them in front of me. Do you have them in front of you?
The ones I'm aware of, Mr. Chair, are an OLCC bill to deal with small distilleries.
Correct.
Farm implement.
Farm dealers. Implements, I understand from Roger Beyer that they're not there.
Right.
I mean, I called them over the weekend. Okay. He said they're not there, so that one will not be.
I'll wait till 2019.
And I think you just last night agreed to another one.
Did I?
Yeah, you did. You just didn't know it. They were going to put it in my committee, and I don't have room for it.
Well, this is the president's request.
Correct.
That we do a transit bill for Salem. Yeah.
Yeah.
Courtney's bill.
What is it? A chicken? Another chicken bill?
A transit bill for Salem.
You could call it that.
So that one's that one's on your plate now.
And the other one, I've been working with Senator Olson on reintroducing in some form, although he hadn't given it to me yet, the reorganization of the Department of Energy.
Okay.
So those are the ones I know about, unless the president has another one.
Who knows?
So, Mr. Chair,
are you agreeable with at least one of those?
Sure.
There we go. We're in business.
Mr. Chair, if I can, the process for submitting a drafting request is that at your direction, I will submit all of them. For one of the three, Senator Thompson will have to send me an email indicating that he is approving of one of those three drafting requests by specifying which one. And then when I submit that request to council, I add that. I add that email from you to there, and that confirms that you're officially
You need an email from him?
Yeah, well, that's okay. they want the documentation for the drafting request.
You'll send me the request?
Yeah, well, as soon as I get the one, I'll send it. All you have to do is say, I agree. That's literally all you need to do. And then, yeah, and then reply.
Okay. Patrick would ask the people who are the usual suspects who play in this courtroom about that, and that's what we've gotten so far. Short session.
Sounds good.
Sounds short. You're working on a work group still.
Yes.
At least tomorrow.
Yeah, that means tomorrow morning.
19.
At 8 o'clock.
You're still
at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning.
Beating up on the farm guys to.
Right early.
Hopefully they'll come up with something.
You do. You know what?
They have
farm implement dealers.
Oh yeah,
DMV has some stuff they're bringing.
Sounds like
DOJ has some stuff they're bringing in. I understand a lot of you are bringing some stuff too.
We're adjourned.
Some stuff too.
We're adjourned.